This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Well, good evening. I'm Dr. Mark Schumacher at UCSF Division of Pain Medicine, the Department of Anesthesia and Perioperative Care. And it's my pleasure to welcome you all back for our third lecture in this series. We're in for a real treat this evening. We have Dr. Paré. He's a clinical professor in the Division of Pain Medicine in the Department of Anesthesia and Perioperative Care here at UCSF. He also is our director of the Neuromodulation Service within the division. He earned his PhD from UC Berkeley, where he investigated analgesic properties of endogenous compounds. And later, he continued his studies in spinal cord stimulation at Johns Hopkins. Never to be bored, he continued further research in neuropathic pain at Stanford, where he also earned his medical degree and completed his residency in anesthesia. Returning or coming to UCSF, he completed his interventional pain medicine fellowship here at UCSF, and subsequently he worked in private practice in the Bay Area for 15 years. Up until just recently, with a tremendous amount of arm twisting, he was able to join our faculty recently, and it's been a great pleasure thus far. He currently serves on the board of the North American Neuromodulation Society and also on the research committee for the International Neuromodulation Society. His recent research activities include his role as principal investigator in the dorsal root ganglion stimulation accurate study. What we're looking forward to tonight is really a focus on interventional techniques evolving, to help manage often chronic pain states that have in the past typically failed what we might consider conventional management or medications. I haven't told him this, but what I'd like his charge to be is to convince us that maybe perhaps one day soon that such approaches will actually be leading rather than trailing our approaches to intractable pain problems. So with that, Dr. Paré.
Great. Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here and excited to be able to discuss some of the new things that are out there. And we're going to start off with a little bit of history lesson, both current political history and old political history, so that we get a perspective on why I believe this is the field that should be leading the way. And I actually hope to answer that charge today. So how many here in the audience saw the President's State of the Union address last month? Well, quite a few. Now, do you recall that these are my disclosures. I do have to say these. I'm consultant for a number of companies, Medtronic, Spinal Modulation, St. Jude, Saluda, Nalu, Mallinckrodt, and Stimwave. My board of director memberships, Mark mentioned earlier. So here's what struck me. In the first 2 minutes of President Obama's State of the Union address, he talks about, so I hope we can work together this year on helping people who are battling prescription drug abuse and heroin abuse. I'm thinking to myself, this is the last time he will be able to speak to the American public. The last hour he will give this speech to the entire nation. Why is it the very first minute of that speech talks about prescription drug abuse? I thought that was rather interesting. But then you have to understand why that is. Here we see this article that just came out last month, January 14th, 2016, a compilation of all the CDC data that looks at our quadrupling of prescription drug abuse over the last 15 years. Heroin abuse follows right behind it. When we look at how many people are actually abusing prescription drugs, ranges between 10 and 12 million people in the United States, and about a million people are now abusing heroin. The question is, where is this happening? Well, back at the turn of the century, this was happening in a few small, isolated areas throughout the country. Then 5 years later, it was growing. And 5 years after that, there's only a few places where this problem isn't becoming a major issue. For me, the most telling story was the fact that in 2011, drug overdoses was killing more people than car accidents. I found that to be a shock. The CDC has decided that this is actually an epidemic that needs immediate attention. Here they state that 15,000 people die every year of overdoses involving prescription painkillers. 1 in 20 people in the U.S. are reported to abuse painkillers. And in 2010, there was enough medication used to medicate every American adult around the clock for a month. By comparison, let's look at the Ebola epidemic. 11,000 deaths during the 2014 and 15 epidemic. The CDC deployed 2,400 personnel to West Africa, and within the first year had tremendous impact on reducing that epidemic's impact. Yet, with all our resources, we can't seem to make a dent in this problem. Certainly the public media has certainly shown plenty of examples of celebrities that are engaged in or have died from prescription overdose. And so the question is, and I think this is a really important point here, is to remember what we're saying, prescription drug abuse. So by definition, that means somebody's got to write the prescription. Who's writing the prescription? Usually just one doc. We have almost 90% of all the folks who say they're abusing medications are either coming from a friend and family, or they took from a friend and family, or for one doctor. And that can only be traced, that can all be traced back to just one doctor. It's only one doctor's step between the person abusing and who's actually writing that prescription. So as much as I like to say it is a problem of society and the public and whatnot, this is really a question about who's writing the prescription. And unfortunately, that's us doctors. Here we see that the number of painkiller prescriptions per 100 people in the purple states actually exceeds every single man, woman, and child in the state. Here, we're close to one per every individual, and even here in California, we're at least every other. So that means half this audience have gotten a prescription for opioids within the last year. So why are doctors writing more and more prescriptions? There's some history to this. The Congress issued a law dedicating the 2001 to 2010, the decade of pain control and research. The American Pain Society, and JACO took this on as well, to say that pain is the fifth vital sign. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid established pain specialty codes, interventional pain codes. The World Health Organization and the International Association for the Study of Pain came and actually dedicated October 11, 2004 as being the Global Day Against Pain, and issued the mandate that the relief of pain should be a human right. No one's here going to argue with that. You know, we definitely want everyone to have their pain treated. The American Pain Society in 2000 said, yes, they had a banner saying directing the future with greater access to opioids for pain control. But they also meant, or they ended up resulting in people also having greater access. And in our country, we have found whenever there's greater access, then there's greater abuse. And the two things go hand in hand. They, on their poster, they say dictating or directing the future today. And I often wonder now, was that a prophecy or a promise? The real issue that really hit the pain community hard was in 2001 when the Bergman versus Chin case was finally settled. Dr. Chin was accused of not giving a cancer patient on their deathbed medication, and he was not sued for malpractice because malpractice has a limit, a very small limit. He was actually charged with and convicted of elder abuse. 2 months after that case closed, the California State Assembly issued a law stating that every single physician in the state of California needed an extra 12 units of pain training. And in that pain training, they had to understand the treatment of the terminally ill. This is also the same time when, under the leadership of Dr. Steve Maffei here at UCSF, instituted the palliative care service to better help and treat patients in their dying days. Another key component to this urge for our community to definitely make sure we have plenty of prescriptions available to our patients in need was discussions by Russell Portnoy. He was a leader in pain management at the Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and he would go around the nation promoting titrate opiate dose to effect, pain relief that there was no ceiling effect, so if the patient still had pain, give more medication. And this was what the general thought was at the turn of the last century. Unfortunately, this was not a good defense for Dr. Tsang, who last week, this is all current events here, last week was the first doctor ever in the history of the United States of America to be convicted of murder with 30 years to life just for prescribing opioids. She didn't inject them. She didn't make them take them. She was just writing the prescription. And now she'll be serving 30 years of life for that activity. And now Dr. Portnoy has been reported in 2012 to the Wall Street Journal that he admitted that he erred in overstating the benefits and diminishing the risk of opioid analgesics. So no wonder that physicians are in this position. Damned if they do, damned if they don't. It's the biggest stressor we see in the pain clinic, we see in the pain field. Patients and doctors are really struggling what to do next. This is not new, however. Like they always say, history repeats itself. And if you're not paying attention, you don't understand the history. Here we see that a leading physician in the mid-1800s, Dr. Spenders, stated that certain it is that the medical man who, from ignorance or timidity, withholds hypodermic medicine from a patient afflicted with cancer is guilty of indirectly permitting a huge quantity of unnecessary pain, and with our present knowledge, he is totally without excuse. This could have certainly been someone that was testifying against Dr. Chen, exactly the same scenario over 150 years ago. The new event then was the isolation of morphine and the hypodermic needle. And certainly right after the Civil War, we had lots of addiction to opioids, and primarily opium. It was readily available. It was in all the elixirs. There was no regulation to this. It was readily available throughout this country. And if you were to ask for help for your addiction to opium, you were allowed to have an elixir of heroin. Much better treatment than your opium. And if that didn't work, you can always get your morphine. You can see over here in the corner, I thought this was rather curious, that if you're a physician, you can actually ask for free samples of morphine be sent directly to your clinic. Here you have Bayer producing their heroin with their aspirin, and the Wyeth brothers making heroin syrup that you could use as needed. It wasn't until the Harrison Narcotics Act in 1914 that there started to be some regulation. This was a tax law. It wasn't a medical law. It wasn't a medical practice law. It was a tax law. You could still give heroin to anybody you wanted, and you can put it in the syrup if you want it, but you had to pay a $1,000 tax. And if you were a doctor, you only had to pay a dollar tax. And certainly, when this law was passed, a number of doctors went to jail because they were accused of not practicing medicine when, in fact, they were trying to treat addicts. And the government didn't believe that was a medical practice. So here we are. Do we give whatever is necessary to treat the patient despite the societal concerns, or do we protect ourselves and society at all costs and therefore limit medication to patients? Or do we try a balanced approach? My argument today is maybe we should have a third option. And that option is to use technology that we have advanced in the last 30, 40 years to use electrical stimulation or implantable intraspinal drug infusion pumps. Now, is this new? No, not at all. Here we see that Scribonius Largus in 46 AD wrote that the use of electrical stimulation to treat pain by taking a torpedo fish, and either if you had foot pain, you put your foot on the fish, or if you had a headache, you put the fish on your head. We're talking about 50 to 200 volts is what these fish can generate. So it definitely gives you quite the shock. Now, of course, you can't go say anything about electricity if you don't have Thomas Edison involved, right? So he made his little device here, the Magno Electric Vitalizer, worn in the low back area there. And oddly enough, it doesn't look that much different than some of the spinal cord stimulators we use now. By World War II, we were using transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulation. And then came the 1965 Melzack and Wall gait control theory. This is just an interesting theory that came about that looked at some of the other pain nerves. As I know this slide is a bit complicated, so I'm going to go through this very carefully, understanding that this was a very beginning theory, but at least this theory suggested why is it that there are these two pain nerves converging onto this basically another pain nerve that's sending information to the brain, and then this non-pain nerve, this sort of a touch nerve. Let me just explain to this. You remember when you were a child, you touched the hot stove. Remember that? And you pulled your hand away and you shook it. The theory goes that your shaking it activates these A-beta fibers and then reduces your overall pain. And we all do that. It's instant. You know, sort of happens immediately. Now, we know that this theory has got lots of challenges, but nonetheless, this was the beginning of understanding where we might want to go with electrical stimulation. And that's why 2 years later, the first stimulator was thought to activate this set of nerves. That first stimulator was placed by Dr. Seeley. And that was the beginning of understanding where are we going to go with neuromodulation? Are we going to try to find the precise nerves that are giving us trouble and focus on minimizing that activity? And maybe it was just in the foot. Maybe we can identify the nerves down here and just minimize that activity. Or go to the cells of those foot nerves and stimulate here. Or even better yet, if there's a lot of nerves involved, the whole leg is involved, then you want to actually stop the signal as it's going up the spinal cord. Whatever you do, it's a signal that you're trying to stop before it gets to the brain, where you experience pain. That's the objective of neuromodulation. Here is the first spinal cord stimulator placed by Dr. Seeley in 1967. As you can see, it's a rather large device. They cut open the sac of fluid called the dura that surrounds the spinal cord. Had lots of complications with it, got infected, had some problems, and it was a bit of a challenge. Then came the smaller electrodes that could be placed through a needle. The first one's placed by Dr. Hasabuchi, neurosurgeon here at UCSF, and he sort of led the way on how to do this with minimal invasive technique. But I found it interesting, in his 1972 paper, he states, "We also found it difficult to explain such an elegant neurophysiological principle as electrical analgesia to the patient. Patients were skeptical regardless of the degree of their suffering." They're larger devices, they have a fair amount of risk, and so I'm not that surprised. So what we needed to do over the next 30 years is make them smaller, simpler, and easier to use. And in fact, that's exactly what we've done. They become smaller, easier to place, the batteries become much smaller, and the programming has gotten tremendously better. With our capability of micro and nanotechnology and computers, we can now stimulate various components along the electrode array here, change frequencies and amplitudes, and really fine-tune which nerve groups we want to stimulate and affect. So who's got these things? This is one of the oldest celebrities I know that has one. He's had one since the 1990s, I believe. It's Jerry Lewis, who said after all of his years of pratfalls, having lots of back and leg pain, he was actually ready to commit suicide. And he reported this to the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And as he was standing there with his gun and ready to commit suicide, his daughter walked in and he told her, oh, it was just a joke. But then he found some help in spinal cord stimulation and has been a big proponent of it ever since. So in the last 15 years, we've seen the growth of spinal cord stimulation grow tremendously by three major companies. And primarily, they're looking at making the battery smaller. You can see how large this one is initially. And this is actually one of the more advanced ones. I didn't have any of the older ones. But now they're smaller. They're rechargeable. We used to have only four contacts, and we went to eight contacts, and now we have 16, giving us the ability to actually stimulate throughout the entire vertebral bodies, three or four vertebral bodies, and really control the pain that's out there. Used to be the only way to get large paddle arrays across the spinal cord was to do a surgery and open up part of the bone and take that away and slip it in with a large open surgery. However, now we have devices that can go in through a small needle and then unroll right over the spinal cord. And then there are the other issues that have come up with spinal cord stimulation, including the electricity when you're placing this has to go through a large, thick cerebral spinal fluid layer to finally get down to the nerves that are a concern. And then when a person changes positions from a sitting position down to a lying position in this nature, you can see the spinal cord gets closer to the leads, give them an extra shock. Not something they're particularly crazy about. So, how do you deal with that? You can actually change where your target is to stimulate, or you can actually put an accelerometer on, just like this iPhone, which I didn't even know that this did this until my son showed me how it works. You watch it in a standard form. It has a simple computer, but you turn it sideways, you get a scientific computer. So you put one of those positioners in your battery generator, and it will know what position you're in and change your stimulation accordingly. Used to be that MRIs were not compatible with these type of devices, but with special shielding, we can now do MRIs with these devices as well. And here we see a device right here in the back with good MRI quality. but it doesn't always work. That's been the biggest struggle for us. We typically do trials. Matter of fact, all companies and all devices, we do trials. The trials last for a few days, and it's just a needle poke. The wire goes in, and then if it works, we pull it out. If it doesn't work, we pull it out. And then we ask the patient, did it or didn't it work? If it did work, then we go on to implant. For some conditions, more difficult conditions, like isolated back pain, as we see here for Hulk Hogan, he had one place for his back pain, and certainly he had just as many falls as Jerry Lewis did, and it didn't work quite as well. So he went on for more back surgery. So it's one of the things that we've been challenged with. And so when I look at this graph of these three major companies growing, I said, this has been fantastic. They provided wonderful benefit. But what am I most excited about? I'm most excited about, and what I really want to focus some attention today on, I'm most excited about the little tiny purple dots here at the top. What are those? Those are the new biotech companies that are just down the road. Three or four of them or five of them, they're growing up like gangbusters. And they are trying to solve the problems that we are facing every day. They're the ones saying, well, if it's not working for this, that, and the other, what can we do to make it work better? And that's why I'm so excited to be in this field of neuromodulation. And to give you sort of an analogy, I believe we're in the same place today as infectious disease specialists were back in the 30s. So my grandmother, who is still alive, she's 102. She was born in 1913. When she was born, there was one antibiotic. When my mother was born in 1931, there were three antibiotics. When I was born in 1958, there were 23, and when my son was born in 1996, there were 29. You can see that once you start to take off understanding what you're doing, developing the idea, then you can really exponentially grow once you have an idea of what you're doing. And I think that's where we are today. Back in 1990, we had one stimulator, 2003, and now in 2016, we have six on the market, and let me tell you, there's three or four more about to be released this year. So it's growing very, very rapidly for a lot of different conditions and a lot of different reasons. But I think this is the reason why it's so exciting to be in this field today. What are the things that we're looking forward to changing right away? We're looking at changing the targets. It used to be just right over the spinal cord, but now we know that we can stimulate the peripheral nerves, the dorsal root ganglion, a group of cells that go to the peripheral nerves, the nerve roots. We can also change the stimulation paradigm. We usually just give one type of square wave pulse and the same frequency and the same shape. Now we're understanding that's not necessarily the best approach for every type of condition. We can change the frequency, bunch them up together, spread them apart, change the waveform, and actually get better benefit. Another study that just came out in 2015 looked at the old stimulation versus the new stimulation paradigms and found that if you take the standard leads here, and as they compare them to the new high frequency, we're looking at 60 hertz versus 10,000 hertz. No nervous system operates anywhere near this range. So this is why we know the gate control theory really can't be applied in this range. Something else is going on. There's a lot more going on that we know about, but obviously the initial thought was that would give you a complete block and the person would fall down and be paralyzed if you tried 10,000 hertz. And a lot of us thought that. It turned out not to be the case. In fact, what happens is people don't feel the paresthesias at all, and they're getting decent pain control. This is the type of control that we typically see with standard stimulation. About 50% of the people get about 50% benefit in their pain. It's okay. It's good. It's not bad, but it could definitely be better. So with this new device, we're looking at closer to 80% improvement for the back pain. Leg pain, same thing, 50% response. High frequency, we're going to get 80% response. Here we can see the pain scores have dropped from 8 to 2 on average for the high frequency versus from 8 to 4 for the lower frequency. So that's just one problem. The back pain has been a real struggle for us, but there are other struggles as well. This is a case study of complex regional pain syndrome. This is a very, very difficult pain problem that was first described in right after the Civil War as well. And when you have a nerve injury and the foot becomes extremely sensitive, it swells up, changes colors, just doesn't really work well at all. Patients can't walk on it, they can't wear shoes. And stimulation with this has certainly been effective, but still difficult to isolate just the foot. Well, more breaking news. All the stuff I'm telling you about is all within the last few weeks. This is just February 17th, 2016, just a few days ago. The International Neuromodulation Society put this on their website, stating that for the first time ever, a device has been FDA approved to stimulate not the spinal cord, but actually the little group of cells off to the side called the dorsal root ganglion. And those cells will send the neurons down to the foot, and we can get more refined stimulation in an area that we couldn't do before. Here's the same patient with one of those leads in place right underneath the coming outside the spine, just like over here, just coming out and putting it right there. And this is a side view, seeing the only small four contacts. Very, very small, much smaller than anything else that's ever been produced. This has been approved by the FDA on 2/12/2016. Once again, just last week. This is all breaking news stuff. What happened to this gentleman? This is the left foot pre-stimulation. Remember you saw that picture? This is 4 weeks later, and here we are 6 months later. Completely normal foot, walking without any problem. So we've just completed the one-year study, actually getting close to closing up the two-year data on this study. And here's some of the initial findings. We find that standard stimulation with the old stimulators we had was very effective, 72%. But with the new dorsal root ganglion stimulators, we're now getting to 93%. So the question that Mark asked me, I didn't even know he was going to ask that question. I'm glad you did, because this is the real question. At what point in time do I no longer need to do a trial? When I'm getting up into the high 90th percentile, maybe it's better just to go straight to treatment because we can get people treated quicker and faster. All right. When was the last time you heard that we're going to do, well, we do some trials for pacemakers, but usually your heart rate's low, you're not doing well, yeah, you get a pacemaker because we know that it helps 99% of the time. If we can get our devices to be in that kind of efficacy, maybe we can actually start going straight to effective treatment right away. So I do have patients who say, this is all great and dandy, but I'm not crazy about having a battery implanted. You know, does it leak? Do I have to change it out? How often do I have to change it out? I don't really want a battery. So are there any new technologies that we can use that don't require batteries? Well, in fact, just FDA approved a little over a year ago, is a device that's so small that the electronics can barely be seen. The electronics can actually be placed inside the canal where the leads are. This device, this is the lead, just like the other leads you saw, about the same size. You can see here, the entire computer is all in something that's just a few millimeters in diameter. Instead of having it connected to a battery, however, it has an antenna. And that antenna picks up the electromagnetic radiation, or in this case, either microwaves or radio signals that are generated by the externalized generator. You can wear this as a belt. You can wear it as a necklace. But some way that you pick up the signal and just generate the power necessary to stimulate that generator. This similar device, and the same device, same company, but this is not FDA approved yet. This is under investigation here in the U.S. currently. But you can see the lead is exactly the same, and here it's actually being placed for the treatment of headaches, right over the eye and down into the face. And here are the little, you can barely see them, little tiny lines here. These are the electronics. And what's the battery or the generator source? The little earpiece that you wear. So this is under investigation currently in the U.S., but I anticipate we'll see it out on the market in not too much more time. But this is what really excites me. I'm telling you all about the things that can stimulate the nerves. I'm telling you that the old theories of the gait control theory are mediocre at best. They may or may not be accurate, but we don't really understand exactly what we're doing. However, for the first time ever, we have a new device that will actually measure what the neurons are doing while we are doing the stimulation. So it's actually picking up the signals from the spinal cord downstream from where the stimulation is happening. This information is then being fed back into the battery to control and make the device work more precisely for that particular individual. This sort of closed-loop feedback is very exciting, and I think it's not only exciting because it'll help provide better sensation for the patient and better care for the patient, but also it'll help us understand a little bit better about what we're really doing. We don't really know exactly what each of the neurons is doing and how as a collective unit they're actually working when we're doing these things. And now we have the ability to study this. This device, this investigation is currently being evaluated by the FDA and is due to start here in the United States this year. So ultimately, what we really want to understand is the experience of pain. I know you had a lecture by Dr. Pullins who talked about pain being an emotional experience, and we all believe that. It's more than just the nociception issues that are coming up from the spinal cord. Ultimately, it gets to the brain, and we experience that as some sort of an event, an emotional event and a sensory event combined. So what does that mean about our spinal cord stimulator? How does it affect our expectations, our catastrophizing, our mood? These are things we just don't know yet. But these are some of the questions we're asking here at UCSF, trying to look at things like fMRI and PET scans and EEGs as we're doing the stimulation and see if we can actually figure out what's actually going on at the brain level. This is the area that I think is the most exciting for us to be studying at this point in time. Let's move on now to something a little bit different. Let's say the electrical stimulation doesn't work. What then? Another device that we use is, as you can see, a catheter. It's a little tiny tube placed inside the spinal fluid that delivers pain medication to the pain neurons that are causing the problem. Right now, you take a medication, you put it in your mouth, it gets into your stomach, gets into your bloodstream, circulates around your body, goes to your brain, your liver, your kidneys, goes to all your body. Where's the pain signal happening? A few neurons right there on the spinal cord. How much actually gets there? We estimate that approximately 1/100th to 1/300th of the amount of medication you take gets to the spot where you actually need it. The rest of it's going to places that are causing all sorts of problems. Sedation, constipation, nausea, vomiting, you name it, all these other side effects that you don't really want. You just want the pain control. So we have a device that does that, a device that can be implanted and holds either 40 or 20 mils. And this is not a real motor inside this pump, but it's a similar type of motor that pushes medication through the tubing and out into a tube that goes to your spinal fluid. Most of the devices these days have activators, so if you need a little extra, you just activate it by pushing the button, and you get a little extra medication. You come to your clinic and your doctor's office, and you refill it every month or two or 3 months, depending on your needs. And these typically last for between 6 and 7 years, and then they need to be replaced. But it's a lot easier and a lot simpler than the medications that are taken by mouth. And people often ask me, wow, this looks very expensive and high tech. But it turns out that my patients who have this spend far less money on medications for this than they ever did on their oral meds. The average cost is about $200 for maybe 3 months' supply. OxyContin will run you that in a month, all right, and have all sorts of problems and side effects associated with it. The medication goes into the CSF. And the question you might have is, well, how does it move around? How does it get to different spots? The important thing is to put the catheter where the main pain problem is. There isn't a pump. There is no heart that pushes medication through, or the fluid through the CSF. But the pulsatile nature of the heart actually causes a little oscillation in the fluid. And you can see here, going back and forth, so sort of a motion toward the head and a motion toward the foot with each cycle of the heart. And that sort of agitates the medication to get a little bit better flow. So let's talk about a couple of patients. This is a patient who I don't know. This is off the internet, but there's a whole page on his experience. It's a former NFL player, Patrick Jay, who developed multiple sclerosis and left him with a severe spasticity and pain in the lower extremities. They tried taking oral medications. One of the most common is baclofen, and the problem with baclofen is it can cause tremendous sedation. And by the time you get the drug up to a high enough level to help with the spasticity, you might be completely comatose. Very little bit is absorbed and gets to the actual spinal cord areas where you need it. So for some patients, it's just not good enough to take orally. So he had a trial that was actually a small dosage of the medication injected into the spinal fluid, and that provided such good benefit that he went on to get an implanted pump. And this actually significantly reduced his pain and completely eliminated his lower extremity spasticity. Now I want to bring up somebody I do know, someone I highly respect, and he's a valued member, sort of a leader here at UCSF. His name's Dr. Stephen McPhee. And yes, he did allow me to discuss this case. I talked to you about him before. He was our founder of the Palliative Care Service here at UCSF. And he is the 2007 Lifetime Achievement in Mentoring Award here at UCSF. He is receiving next month the 2016 American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine National Leadership Award. UCSF professor of medicine and author of 40 books, 75 book chapters, and 175 scientific articles. And let me tell you, I didn't know any of that when he walked through my door. He is the most modest guy you'll ever meet. All I knew was he told me, I'm a 64-year-old guy, and I like to do some writing, and I'm having a hard time doing my writing with my peripheral neuropathy. I take the medications, and they work. And I'm getting side effects, and I can't concentrate on all the writing that I have to do. I'm going to go on sabbatical for the next 4 months to write two more books, and I need to be able to be clear-headed. But the medication doesn't allow me to be clear-headed, and if I don't take the medication, I'm in too much pain to concentrate on what I'm doing. I said, fine, let's try this intrathecal therapy. We tried a trial of medication, and we found one that worked for him, and he resumed his writing and lecturing, and like I say, he's off in Chicago now giving, or in a few weeks, be giving a lecture on his actual condition. I'd say, who better to actually explain the nature of this? I've never had a patient who is actually a leading national expert on the best ways ever to manage pain with oral medications and address all of the side effects appropriately. He is our leader here at UCSF. He started the palliative care service, which talks about how to manage with medications, oral medications. And even he found it difficult to actually get the kind of control he was looking for. One of the leading papers that really focus in on this issue of drug toxicity was published in 2000 by Smith et al. And so what it did, it took cancer patients with severe pain that were getting plenty of opiates, plenty of medications, but having lots of problems. And they gave them to the people they thought were the best people to give them, to look at their management and sort of take over their management. Who would that be? People just like Dr. McPhee. Palliative care specialists who concentrate their attention on addressing the fatigue, confusion, and all anorexia, constipation, all the nausea, all the issues associated with these medications. And certainly they did a wonderful job. You can see here that all the red bars, they were able to use stimulants to address the fatigue, laxatives to address the constipation, appetite stimulants to address the anorexia, anti-nausea medications to address the nausea issues. So something to actually manage all these problems. And yet, even in the best case scenario, even with these highly specialized, trained physicians who only do this kind of work, they still could not reach the success with reducing the mean severity of all of these side effects as compared to intrathecal therapy or pump therapy. You can see here, especially in fatigue and depressed levels of consciousness. Why is that? Because if I'm using 1 milligram of morphine compared to 300 milligrams of morphine, that's what we think the comparison is. We believe 1 milligram of intrathecal morphine is equivalent to 300 milligrams of oral morphine. 1 milligram of morphine in the spine directed right over the area where the problem is just isn't going to get out and go to the brain and cause the kind of problems that 300 milligrams is going to cause. Just like it's not going to cause the constipation problems and all the other problems that are going to all the other organs because it's such a small dosage. So this is the main question, I guess, Mark asked me to address tonight, which is, how do we decide when to do this? This is the World Health Organization analgesic ladder. This analgesic ladder states that you should start with cognitive behavioral therapy. I'm sure Dr. Poland's talked about some of that. You can go up to small dose systemic opioids and nerve blocks, and you don't really get to the advanced technologies to the very end. Certainly they're more expensive, at least on the surface. If you actually look, they're actually not more expensive, but on the surface, they look to be more expensive. And no one would say that you stubbed your toe yesterday, you need a spinal cord stimulator today, all right? That's just not going to be practical or any sense at all. However, the time from diagnosis to spinal cord stimulation or pump trial is often measured in years. It's not uncommon for me to see someone who has never heard of this type of therapy, and they've been suffering from pain for 5, 10, 15 years. No one's ever mentioned it to them. And I hate to say it, but this is a mini medical school lecture here, and I would venture to say that everyone in this audience has now received more education about neuromodulation than the vast majority of medical students throughout the nation. It's just not part of the curriculum at this point in time. Hopefully, it'll grow to be that part. This really does concern me a bit because I remember some of my lectures in medical school, and one in particular was my first year. And what did they tell me about? They said, hey, there's this device that if you have a slow heart rate, we can put this device in and turn it on, and it increases your heart rate. It's called a pacemaker. Has anyone in here not heard of a pacemaker? Exactly. Everyone knows that pacemakers exist. It's just another neuromodulation device. But when it comes to the treatment of pain and a lot of the other diseases we're now treating it with, we don't even put this in our basic curriculum. So instead of waiting multiple years before they even get exposed to a physician who can offer this, or have to have high doses of opioids, which we just learned earlier that is causing an epidemic in this country because we are writing prescriptions for lots of opioids. We need an alternative. This is a viable alternative for many of these patients, and we should be taking this much earlier, not waiting 5 and 10 years out, seeing if we can actually change the function of the nervous system when a person has an intractable pain problem early on and not make them suffer for years and years and years. This is a paper written by Christian et al. In 2012, and they were actually discussing medications and how to devise the selection of medications specifically for the individual. Well, my feeling is this is the same approach that we should take for all of our therapies. We have the etiology of the problem, but we also have the genotype of the patient and the individual factors for the patient. This individual pathophysiology needs to be considered when we're actually addressing the problems of an individual patient and then devise a plan that's based on that individual. So maybe we have one type of stimulation called tonic stimulation, another called burst, maybe the DRG stimulator. Maybe I need a pump. Maybe I need meditation. It doesn't really matter. But you really need to focus your attention on the individual and understand that will be the focus of how we, I think, move forward in our care of our patient population. I and a group of colleagues have written a series of papers on this very issue about how do you make the decision to select a neuromodulation device compared to device A versus treatment X. Well, let's take that CRPS case. Remember the one we talked about earlier? With the guy with the foot for multiple years and lots of therapy. That looks like a very severe condition. And so someone would argue, yes, but we don't want to go to a device that costs $30,000 right off the bat. Well, not right off the bat. How many years do you need to wait to actually move forward? And are you actually saving money? So Taylor et al. Did a series of studies looking at how much does it cost to actually spend more money with physical therapy and medications compared to a device of this nature. And that time point, 2 years. Then every day after 2 years, you're spending more money than you would have if you were actually using this type of device. So this came up just 2 days ago in the operating room. I was teaching a fellow to put in a device, and she was saying, how do we select this one over that one? I said, it's very simple. You just use the algorithm that we've published several times in the last few years. They're about various pain conditions. And we start with, even though I like safe, when I sort of came up with this, I like the word safe, it actually makes more sense to start with the E and not the S. So I'll start with the E. E is effectiveness. We first have to make sure that the device that we're using is effective for the problem. And we've seen that some of these devices are more effective than other devices for certain problems. So you identify the right device for the right patient. You have to make sure it's safe. If a patient needs repeated MRIs, well, I want to make sure I have a device that has the capability of being used in an MRI. If I have a patient that someone who's a drug abuser and will go through all means to abuse drugs, well, maybe that's not an appropriate patient for a pump because there have been a number of reports of patients accessing their port, pulling out their drugs and injecting them intravenously. So that's maybe not an appropriate patient, but a stimulator might be an appropriate device for that kind of patient. And the one that people worry about most is the fiscal neutrality. And that's where you have to look at the cost of treatment A compared to treatment B, not on day one when they are being compared, but down the line. Like I say, for spinal cord stimulation compared to physical therapy and exercise, the cost merges at 2 years. For repeat back surgery, for non-malalignment issues, just sort of chronic back and leg pain, compared to doing a repeat surgery, the time to fiscal neutrality is day one. It's cheaper than going back for more surgery, and it's more effective. Those studies have been reported by Dr. North out of Johns Hopkins over the last 15 years, and it keeps coming up to be the case. So in essence, what I'm talking about in terms of the SAFE principles is something that Dr. Osler talked about years ago when he stated that it is much more important to know what sort of a patient has a disease than what sort of a disease a patient has. This is what most people think about when they think about neuromodulation devices. Is this what I'm talking about? Is this the future that we have to look forward to? I say, no, this is not our future. This is our future. This is a gentleman who came to me with an amputation and neuropathic pain after the amputation. And I was feeling pretty good with myself that he was getting some pain relief with this and was able to do things. The last thing I expected him to do was walk in the office and challenge me to one of the biggest bike races in the nation. I didn't have the heart to say no, knowing doggone well that I was not in good shape. He was a formerly, he did a lot of biking, and so I said I would go with him on this trek. A few months after this race, he actually rode all the way down to Los Angeles. I told him I wasn't going with him on that ride. That was too far from me. But this is what neuromodulation looks like. And so for those who say that they don't like the or trust these newfangled neuromodulation devices, I have only one thing to say to them. Resistance is futile. They're here to stay, and we're going to have a lot more opportunities to allow these devices to give greater hope to our patients, reduce our medication usage, have a huge impact on our opiate abuse and prescription writing. Remember, the prescription drug abuse problem is basically a behavioral problem by physicians writing too many scripts. That's ultimately where it's coming from. You saw it in the FDA. It wasn't that they were getting it off the street or somewhere illegally. They're getting it from us doctors. So we need better options. We need to be teaching this to our general medical students, not our most advanced, experienced and inquisitive many medical students that we have here today. But even the standard medical, younger medical students need to hear about some of these devices early on in their training. Thank you very much for your attention. And we have plenty of time for questions. Yes?
I have a brother-in-law who had his knee replaced and has had 4 operations. And it's, whatever his problem is, it's still extremely painful. Would this be an option for him? Because, you know, like it's swelling and whatever is the problem.
So let me actually rephrase the question a bit, and I'll get back to that detail of that question in just a second. Let me just start by saying that the first thing that I tell a patient when they're in the office and we're talking about the various things that I can do to help their pain, neuromodulation or not, doesn't really matter. As a pain doctor, I make it a point to say, have you seen, in essence, what I call fix-it doctors? Most of the doctors at UCSF and everywhere else, I call them fix-it doctors, because if you're broken, they are designed to fix something. If you have an infection in your knee, no, you're not a neuromodulation candidate. You need to go get that sorted out and get it fixed. I was talking to one of the orthopedic surgeons, and he was saying sometimes he sees people get these devices long before they should because they actually have a severely broken back that needs to be fixed. And I say, I absolutely agree with you. If you have something that needs to be fixed, you should get it fixed. I've seen patients that had cancers on the spine when they got sent to me for an epidural and no one knew they had cancer. I've been referred patients with bilateral chest pain only to find out that they had active pneumonia. So as a pain doc, I deal with pain from the top of the head to the bottom of the foot. And I have to be convinced, and my patients have to be convinced, that their actual underlying pathology has been appropriately addressed by the medical specialists that are, we call the fix-it doctors. Only after they are convinced, and I am convinced, and we know that all of that has been sorted out and there's nothing actively problematic, then we can move forward with neuromodulation. I'll say that for your brother, it is? Brother-in-law. An ongoing study in Europe right now is a look at post-knee surgical pain that has been persistent for more than 6 months and using the dorsal root ganglion stimulator I just talked to you about. So absolutely, but I don't know all the details, so you have to make sure those details are sorted out. And this is not something that's, you know, theoretical for me, that happens once in a while. This happened 2 days ago. I and a patient thought we were on the right track, and we both insisted we should get another neurosurgical opinion, and that opinion led us down a different pathway, and it halted my whole discussion with her. So, oh, you know what? Doesn't look like everybody has sorted this out as well as they should. We have to backtrack. I need you to go see this person and this person and make sure that those things have been sorted out appropriately before we move on with anything. So it's always a caution, but when all the doctors and the average number of doctors that a patient sees before I see them usually runs about 10. All right, usually 10 doctors before I actually see the patient.
We hear so much about neuromodulation and electrical stimulation, and even not just in pain, but also depression. But I'm an economist, and the question is that it seems that these kind of innovations have a harder time in the current paradigm than the drugs. And of course, there's insurance in between, and there. Procedures, how to proceed. You go to a general practitioner, you're miles away from proposing that you should have something that bypasses taking all the drugs and getting all the problems with that. So there's more, first of all, we have to do proper analysis to show that these are beneficial. But who is going to pay for this? The drug companies are paying tons of money to show that their drugs are cost efficient, and insurance companies, prefer it, because I don't know if you take into account that to do a procedure like this, you need medical professional, whereas with the drugs, you just get a prescription. So the cost situation might be, and it's how do we promote this kind of innovation?
We want to create a question.
Basically, how do we change the paradigm by which we, in our medical society and medical economic society, position these in the appropriate place at the appropriate time? I'll answer that in just a second. Let me tell you that this is probably the one most important question that faces everyone in this business. Because of that question that you asked, which I think is the most important question, we on the national board of the North American Neuromodulation Society and the International Neuromodulation Society have formed in the last few years a new organization. That new organization is a working group that combines the industry of the neuromodulation with us physicians around the globe to talk about this very problem. Why is it we know that we can save our patients suffering? We can save money. But why is it still so difficult? Part of it has to do with education. I think the number one problem, and we all agree, is education. Why is it when President Obama said that we need to do something about drug abuse, he didn't say by using more neuromodulation? All right? But you ask about those studies. These are the type of studies that are published here. These are the things that we're investigating. There are studies out there, but you're right. Few and far between. Not as many as we need, but we're scrambling to make more and do more. But this is actually the most important thing. And this goes beyond any individual company. I've met with the presidents of Medtronic, the presidents of Boston Scientific, the president of St. Jude, the president of StemWave. We all recognize the same problem. Lack of education, lack of exposure, and unfortunately also there is a huge lack of trained professionals that do this kind of therapy. We believe that we are... have only one tenth of the number of pain physicians that are needed in this country, and it's a real challenge. It is a thing that keeps us up at night. So your question is critical, but we are working day and night to try and solve this problem. But this is one of the events. This is why, for me, I went to Switzerland last year to give a lecture on neuromodulation. I gave one in Southern California. I gave one on the East Coast as well. And next month I'm going to Australia to give a couple of lectures, and then a week after that I'm going to Hawaii. And you know what disappoints me about all of those? Is that I'm talking to other pain docs, other neuromodulators. I'm going to neuromodulation conferences. Since I've been a neuromodulator for the last 20 years, this is my first event to talk to people who weren't necessarily in the medical field and certainly not in the neuromodulation field. This is the biggest problem I think we face. I should not have to ask you, did you know about a pacemaker? Because you know about pacemakers. But I do have to go through, because you don't necessarily have all the exposure to neuromodulation devices, and I think you should. There is a book, actually. I tell all my patients to read the same book. It's only $15 on Amazon, $7 if you have a Kindle. It's called Pain Wise, and it goes through all of these sorts of things. It's written for patients. It's written for the public. It's a fantastic resource, and when patients read this book and they come back to me with questions, it makes my day so much better because we can get into the fine details of the things that they're interested in understanding more about. But you're absolutely right. That is our number one problem, is lack of education. I think we have to educate not only the public in events like this, but my personal opinion is that this should be a major functional part of every neuromodulation, every medical school curriculum, because you're right. This goes way beyond pain. We have devices. Do you know that we can make a blind person see now? Did you know that? Anybody know that? Right. So you guys are just brilliant. I didn't know that 2 years ago until I went to a meeting. I said, my God, I had no idea. And guess which institution? There's only 8 institutions that can do this. Guess which one of them is one of those institutions? You guessed it. UCSF. The person who invented the first sacral stimulator, invented the stimulator, implanted the first sacral stimulator. UCSF. You saw Dr. Hasabuchi, one of the first pioneers of spinal cord stimulation. We have a number of physicians here treating depression, anxiety, all sorts of things. We've got Dr. Kasri here is looking at treating headaches with neurostimulation devices. So there's a number of things that we're doing. The other device, the other recommendation I would make to you, here's another one. This one is, I think, the second most important reading for the entire population. It's called, it's an article out of March 2015 in Scientific America, and it was written by Kevin Tracy. He was our keynote speaker 2 years ago at NANS, and I tell you, I sat there in the audience with my mouth dropped open because I had no idea that we could treat so many diseases with neuromodulation. And here I am, I'm on the board of the North American Neuromodulation Society, and I had no idea. I figure if I don't know this, then we definitely need to get the word out.
Is there a physical or neurological limitation to where on the spine neuromodulation is effective or inappropriate?
So let me just rephrase the question. What range of the spinal cord do we place these devices?
Yeah.
From the top of the cervical spine to the bottom of the sacral sacrum. So the entire length. I put devices in all of those regions. Okay, well, thank you very much for attending.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.